Welcome to episode 1.2 of part 1 of The Warp and Woof. I'm your host, Grover Elliott, and now I'm going to be covering my second defining characteristic. 2, I am a Christian. Don't worry, as I said, this isn't a religious podcast. There are enough of those out there, but religion will pop up from time to time because it's so central to so many of us, and it figured so heavily at the creation of our country. If you don't consider yourself to be especially religious, that's okay. But you also don't need to be offended or frightened by it. The same goes for the religionist outlook toward atheists, agnostics, and those who are just wondering. Religion is nothing more than a philosophy on how to live life. It's just like any other guiding philosophy, differing only in its believed origin and ultimate consequence. I will say that the one thing we religious people have that you atheists don't is someone to talk to when things get bad or the end is coming. I jest. Just a little twisted sense of humor. If it offends you, just accept my right as an individual to say things I think, regardless of whether I believe them. So what does it mean to be a Christian? I'll bet you have your opinion on that, and I'll wager that you and I disagree on at least some points. Even if you happen to be a Christian, that's okay, because we're individuals, right? As an individual, I've never agreed with anyone, living or dead, 100% of the time. This goes for presidents, philosophers, scientists, actors, even Jesus Christ. That's right, I've disagreed with Jesus. Clearly I have. I'm a sinner, as are all of us. It doesn't mean I was right and he was wrong. It just means that we disagreed on how I should act or behave at a particular time or in a certain circumstance. I will say that in taking stock of those times, he was right and I was wrong. That's okay. I'm an imperfect individual. At the root of being a Christian, and here's a good trivia question for you, is the belief that, 1, Jesus Christ was the Son of God, was God, 1/3 of the Trinity. And no, not the butchie chick in the Matrix movies. 2, he was killed on the cross, truly dead, kaput. 3, he returned in the flesh, not a ghost or an apparition, in the flesh and ascended into heaven. And 4, that Christ will come again to judge both the quick and the dead, not the movie with the butchie chick from Fatal Attraction, all people on the earth, alive or dead. But what did I get from growing up as a Christian, other than a lot of very difficult concepts to come to terms with, like cannibalism, corpses rising from the dead, a trinity at the head of a monotheistic religion? Hey, nobody said being Christian was going to be easy. But what did I get out of the experience? Christianity gave me a basic set of principles, of rules to follow. It gives me guidelines to follow no matter the situation. In fact, that's what this whole exercise is, defining your character traits so that you are equipped with a sort of cheat sheet for life. Have you ever taken one of those bubble fill tests, the ones that look kind of like a Scantron, little circles, A, B, C, D, and E? You fill in the circle with a number 2 pencil, don't leave it partially filled, don't put a check mark, fill in the entire bubble. Well, you probably have. Have you ever seen an answer key for them? It's an identical sheet with the correct bubbles punched out with a hole punch. To use it, you just line it up over the answer sheet, and you can instantly see which bubbles were filled correctly and which weren't. With your defining characteristics and a guiding philosophy on living, you'll be able to do the same thing with pretty much any situation that arises without having to fret and debate with yourself. So what was the central message of Christianity? In a word, love. I know that's not what always comes across, and you may be using your faith in a completely different way, but Christianity is supposed to be about love, which brings peace, or at least gives you a good shot at it. But Christianity so often puts we followers in a perceived position of superiority. We throw our faith around like a dagger far too often. If you aren't a Christian, don't feel particularly persecuted. Fellow Christians throw that dagger at one another in the very same congregation all the time. So why do I follow Christianity? Remember René Descartes that I mentioned? French philosopher, mathematician, all-around interesting cat. He did write, "I think, therefore I am," which was, in my opinion, a kind of tongue-in-cheek philosophical exercise on the existence of a higher power. You should check it out, especially if you're religious. But what everyone should read is his Discourse on Method. In it, he describes starting over from scratch, rejecting and forgetting everything that other people had put into his brain in order to go in search of truth for himself. He made some exceptions, such as his religious moral compass, with the caveat that anything that turned out to be untrue, he would reevaluate and dismiss. Same with me, and I think most Christians. I won't speak for the rest of you. We question things a lot. At times, we may reject God or feel that he has abandoned us. We may decide it's silly to believe in something with seemingly, we're told, no scientific evidence to back it up. Do I know God is real? Of course not. I believe he is real. There is a difference there. I believe he's spoken to me in a dream. I was going through a particularly rough spot in my life. Something had occurred that I felt like I was doomed because of it, and I could not get past it. I couldn't get forgiveness. Then one night in a dream, and I believe this was God speaking to me, I was told, "I'm forgiven, but forgiveness is not complete until I forgive myself." And that helped me get past that period. Now, could it have just been my brain telling me that due to my religious training? Sure, of course it could be. The brain is incredibly powerful, and I've had some fantastical dreams. At the end of it, does it really matter whether it was God or just my brain? I don't know that it matters. It doesn't matter to my faith. It doesn't shake it or solidify it one way or the other. Well, I don't know. Maybe it solidifies it more. But it doesn't really matter. My religious upbringing and my faith helped me get past this period in my life. Can we know God is real? I suppose some can that have had a personal experience, but most of us haven't. And Christians need to understand what that means to atheists. I mean, we call Bigfoot believers crazy. But the thing I've noticed about everyone who believes in Bigfoot, they've had a physical interaction that they believe was with a Bigfoot, with a Sasquatch. They've seen one, felt one, been affected by one in the real world, in meat space. That's a little different than religionists, right? So don't be too quick to point the finger at people. But ultimately, it's everyone's individual decision. I like not knowing some things. I like uncertainty. It keeps new music interesting sometimes. And I found that Christianity was doing me no harm, but so much good. That isn't the case for everyone, which is why everyone has a choice and should make that choice for themselves. Now back to what Christianity is. At the center of modern Christianity is money. I'm just kidding. Though it does seem to be a draw to getting many into Christian leadership, and for many that follow that Christian leadership. It's the modern version of all that self-help, get filthy rich garbage from the 80s and 90s. Find Jesus and find your reward. I'm not in that camp. But at the center of Christianity is Jesus Christ. And we learn about him in the Holy Bible. As you probably know, the Bible is made up of two books, the Old and New Testaments. For those not familiar with the Bible, non-Christian and Christian alike, the two books cover different periods of time. First, the time before Christ, when God was establishing his chosen people, and prophets were foretelling the coming of Christ, although the Gospel of John tells us Christ, the Word, was there at the beginning. And second, the New Testament, covers the birth, ministry, death, resurrection, and legacy of Christ. There it is in a nutshell. There is, though, a universal arc that covers both books. And I don't mean the gold chest that Indiana Jones found or the huge boat that Russell Crowe built. I'm talking about the story and its meaning. Here's where I anger a lot of fellow Christians and Jews. I do not take everything in the Bible literally, but figuratively, especially the Old Testament. And before you get too mad, you do you and I'll do me. And I'll point out that even the Apostle Paul documented the figurative nature of the Old Testament. Now, starting with the story of creation, which, by the way, was written as a poem and is clearly different than the rest of Genesis, we learn that there was a creator of the heavens and the earth. This creator was known by many names. What's in a name? Does your name dictate who you are and what you do? Adolf Hitler was a German despot who tried to eliminate everyone he thought were lesser people, while Adolf of Osnabrück was a German saint known for his charitable programs for the poor and wretched. Your name obviously does not dictate who you are or how you will behave. Names are interesting, though. How many times have you heard people say a child has the perfect name, or the name of a child divides a family over a perceived slight? So what does the name of God really mean? We humans of limited grasp have to refer to God in some way, so we choose names. Do all of those names represent different gods? I don't think so, because I believe there is only one creator. We humans just interpret his essence differently. For instance, the Christians believe God is a personal, living, and loving God. Muslims, and I'm no authority on other religions, I know a bit more about Judaism because it is the foundation of my religion, but I claim to be a Christian, so most of my knowledge, limited though it may be, is about Christianity. But Muslims see God as not personal, but more harshly judgmental, a force to be feared. Which one's correct? Well, there are lots of dead people and at least one pillar of salt in the Old Testament that may ask, what's the dang difference? Indeed. I guess the real differences lie in how each of us lets our God affect the way we treat others around us. And I don't think any of us should blame a God or a religion, but rather look inwards for those uncomfortable answers. Anyway, back to the Bible. We get a story of creation and an explanation of why. The Bible doesn't go into how life is created, but rather why we are different than the other life forms on Earth. God, or Darwin, gave us a brain to figure out the how. We all will forever be grasping for the why. Why do we have a soul and seemingly nothing else does? Sorry, so-called animal lovers, but you likely agree with this. Why are humans evil for killing animals, but the reverse is never true? Why is it amoral for us to kill when nature does it constantly for survival? Let's take it further. Does anyone see it as okay to kill babies? This is not an abortion debate. I'm talking about living, crying, pooping babies. Any species. I don't think anyone believes that is okay. Not even the people wearing giant vagina hats on the Washington Mall. But nature loves killing babies. They're slow, dumb, and easy to harvest. Probably soft on the palate. Watch a nature show. Do you think lions are going to burn in hell after watching them time and time again single out the old, the crippled, or the newborn out of a herd and then eat it while it's still alive? I've read a lot of dystopian novels, and none of them that cover that subject were positive in outlook. I'm not trying to disturb you with this imagery, but elevated life requires asking difficult questions, and an objective life requires gathering data before jumping to conclusions. We're different. So the story of creation is about telling us why we are different. God made us in his own image. Old man with a white beard image? No. With a conscience and an eye for beauty, be it a mountain stream or a star-filled night sky in the desert or Mozart's Requiem. It takes a soul to see the beauty in nature or art or music or your beer-swilling neighbor, Carl. Sometimes it takes a heck of a lot of soul and a really good privacy fence. No offense, Carl. The rest of the Bible covers one overarching theme. God lost his people, all of us, because of our violations of moral law, and he continues to show patience and grace in his effort to get us to come back to him. Her, they, whatever. To see us become the humans, the brothers and sisters, we should all want to be. To be sure, there is a lot more detail contained in the book and some fantastic and practical advice on living. Verse pickers like to throw Leviticus around because of statements about tattoos and homosexuality. But did you know that that book also contains really great advice that the medical community still follows today? Ever heard of quarantine? It's there. Washing to heal? It's there. And much more. At any rate, when you use your religious beliefs to draw battle lines between you and any other individual, individuals made in the image of God, are you staying true to God's overall plan? Not if you're a Christian, you aren't. For Christians, the Apostle Paul told us that you shouldn't get circumcised just to get along with Jews, but you should also not invite a Jew to your home and offend them by serving unclean food. This goes likewise when inviting a Muslim or Hindu or vegetarian. Does it mean you have to eat like them? No. It means you should not actively offend them. If a vegetarian is offended by you eating meat, don't invite them over to watch you barbecue. If they don't mind, make sure you grill the portobellos on a clean part of the grill. My duty as a Christian is to love. I fail quite often, perhaps as much as anyone. But what I get from Christianity is that I am supposed to love and that God is the ultimate father figure. But what about Jesus and the crucifixion, you ask? A loving God killed his only son? Gee, I'll pass. I'm not trying to get into the weeds here, but I must cover this for a few minutes for you to understand where we stand or are supposed to. Christ was God and human, the perfect example for us, kind of like Sheriff Taylor on the Andy Griffith Show. God gave us laws through the early leaders. Now, some of those laws seem a bit earthly, and I question which came from divine inspiration or were just really good ways to keep society ordered, and which ones were designed to keep certain folks elevated over others. I like the first two categories, divine inspiration and ordered society. The third, keeping some down and some up, I have problems with. But then so did Jesus. He was quite active in his defiance of the powers that be. And for his troubles, he was crucified. But here's why. The Old Testament, you may have heard, is full of sacrifice, animal sacrifice to a large degree, though there were other sacrificial items as well. When you study those sacrifices, burnt offerings, carefully, you may find it interesting that most of what was burned for God was inedible anyway. Entrails, sinews, blood. Well, inedible for anyone outside of Great Britain. Just kidding. But keep your blood sausage. I'll take pork jowls stuffed into intestines. Because I was raised on it, darn it. Anyway, a better portion was given to the religious leaders. This was practical so that they could spend their time ministering instead of just trying to subsist, which took a hell of a lot of time and work prior to the Industrial Revolution. Then portions were to be eaten by the person sacrificing. In the case of meat, it had to be eaten within 3 days. That's medically practical, given the biological changes that start occurring in cooked meat that isn't refrigerated. But why the sacrifices? Jesus told us that was no longer required of us. In fact, the prophet Isaiah told us in the Old Testament the same thing, at least to stop sacrificing as a rote, empty gesture. But what do you think was the purpose of those sacrifices in the first place? Forgiveness. They were so that God could forgive us for our transgressions against moral law. Opie had to do that a number of times back in Mayberry. I know this seems to be getting a little thick, but stick with me here. But isn't forgiveness what God's grace is all about? Of course it is. God shows us abundant grace in forgiving us for our sins, just as we should do the same for those who sin against us. But forgiveness requires that a cost be paid by one of the parties involved. Let me give you an example. Let's say you were supposed to mow your parents' lawn and you didn't. Then you came to me for forgiveness. Oh, I can say that I absolve you, but it means nothing. I'm out nothing, and you, well, you enjoyed your Saturday fishing instead of fulfilling an obligation to your parents. My hollow act of absolution means nothing. Neither of us paid a cost. The forgiveness could only be offered by your parents. They paid the price of having their lawn grow high and receiving a notice from the old biddy in charge of the homeowners association. Man, doesn't she have a parking lot to monitor somewhere? You need the forgiveness of your parents, but someone has to pay the cost. The Old Testament sacrifices were that cost. You couldn't just go grab the three-legged lamb with the crooked nostril. You had to bring the best of the best of the best, sir. Or catch a wild bird, or provide some of your hard-earned wheat. This was the rod, the negative reinforcement, the whipping. Do wrong, and it will cost you, Opie. God's grace can get a little camouflage in that ritual, which is why God changed the practice. But there still had to be a cost paid. Otherwise, there is no real forgiveness. How do we apply this concept of forgiveness and cost to our everyday life? Now, here in the States recently, we've had an executive order concerning forgiving college debt. And I know I said I wouldn't get into the weeds with House Bill this and executive order that, but this type of promise has been made a number of times over the years. It's not uncommon. It's a way to buy votes of a younger generation. And every time that this comes up, there's always a kind of a bait and switch issue. It's only forgiveness of certain debts under certain types of situations, and of course it's being challenged in the courts and will probably fail again. Now, do I have a problem in general with forgiving college loan debts? I'll surprise you and say, no, I don't. I read some comments online that said erroneously, if you're a Christian and you believe in God and His grace, then it's your duty to forgive these debts, just as God forgave you your debts. Well, there's a problem with that. It's really bad theology, first of all, and it's illogical. One of the parties involved has to offer the forgiveness. In the case of college loan debt relief, the college loans are being relieved at, I think, $10,000, which is not a whole lot of a current college loan, as college prices have skyrocketed over the years. The people paying the cost is the taxpayer, or future taxpayers, in the case of increased inflation. You see, those loans are going to be paid off. They're not going to be paid off by the person who took the loan out. They're going to be paid off by people that had nothing to do with the decision in the first place. And you can easily blame the students who took these loans. Hey, you took the loan, you pay for it. But let me tell you this. In school, these kids are constantly being told, you've got to go to college, you've got to go to college, you've got to go to college. I mean, they're brainwashed into it. The colleges tell the school counselors, you've got to drive this message home. The only way you're going to be successful is to have a college degree. There's nothing wrong with education. There's nothing wrong with learning new things. But you can do that on your own. And colleges, more and more, universities have devalued the actual education. You're being trained to pass tests. You're being told what the professor's opinion is, or more often than not even the professor, but a grad student, what their opinion is, which generally has nothing to do with the real world because they've been isolated from the real world, or better yet, insulated from the real world for years. Hidden away in their safe little cocoon of higher education. So you've been told, these kids have been told, you got to go to college, you got to go to college. Well, college is very expensive. Lo and behold, there are loans that you can go take out so that you can afford to go to this college. And of course, these loans, as in every loan that is unwise, is backed by the federal government. Yes, Fannie Mae and Sallie Mae at work again. So you can take out these huge loans. They're guaranteed, so colleges can just keep increasing their prices, building these huge centers of higher education that really don't offer a whole lot of education, and sell you for $100,000 a worthless degree. And I'm talking about that. There's nothing wrong with a degree in engineering or mathematics or something that you can take to the real world and make money from, make a real return. But primary education degrees, modern dance degree, where are you going to make money for that? If other people do what your degree is in on TikTok or as a hobby, you probably don't need a degree to do it. Yet these colleges will get you the loan, get you the money to turn right back around to give to them so that they can sell you a worthless degree. It's unconscionable. So when those debts are, quote unquote, forgiven, who's paying the cost? Taxpayers that had nothing to do with the scam in the first place. And be careful, like I said, about just blaming the kids. They're doing what they've been told for years to do. The source of the problem needs to be corrected. Back to biblical forgiveness. So God sacrificed himself in the person of Jesus Christ. This was the ultimate price for all of our sins. God came to earth as a man to live as we do, and in my opinion, to truly live as we do, in order to understand us more fully. That's why I have no problem with people claiming Jesus was married, or Jesus did this, or he did that. God came down to live as a man, sort of the original undercover boss. Then he paid the cost for our forgiveness. There's your grace beyond any. Greater love hath no man than this, that a man lay down his life for his friends. I'm not sure God could demonstrate love and grace in any more powerful way. The perfect role model. My Christian upbringing challenges me to remember that all of us, each individual, was made in the image of God, and my duty here on earth is to love each and every one as I would love myself. I fail, often. We all do. But that isn't the fault of Christianity or Judaism or Islam or Hinduism or any other human perversion of religion. It's our fault, individuals. What is the guide for your moral compass? Does it have to be an old religion? No. But they have been around so long that they've been tweaked for millennia to cover just about every condition and circumstance, even if you don't believe in a God. Here's some of the other things Christianity has taught me. There is something bigger in the world than me. It's not all just about me. The universe doesn't revolve around me. Physics teaches me that too, but we are all created in the image of God. That means our existence is equal. Therefore, I need to love my neighbor as I love myself. It holds me to an ultimate judgment, a consequence in all my actions and even my thoughts. I'm challenged to accept disappointment with grace and to show mercy and forgiveness to others. And digging a little deeper, God put me on this earth for a purpose. My industry, my production, my contribution to the human experience. St. Paul tells us we should think about our jobs that way. You aren't working for you or your boss. You're working for God. Keep that in mind in everything you do, be it assembling widgets, creating art, or managing others. Do it as God would want you to. Here's where biblical Christianity can get tricky and turn a lot of people away. Since 1551, the individual verses of the Bible have been numbered so that one can pick any particular one of them out of context and use it to beat a sinner over the head with. If you aren't a Christian, this may very well be your experience. If you are a Christian, you've likely seen or employed this technique yourself. Or if you are a militant atheist, you may have employed this technique to throw back at self-righteous Christians. Hey, good for you. They probably did something to deserve it. But the verse numbers were put in place for the purposes of study. But just like the internet, the organization of information can be used to enhance or diminish the value of the information itself. The overarching message of love. The Bible was written in book form. Multiple books, chapters, paragraphs. Don't take little bits out of context to use as a dagger. What does your moral guide teach you? Is your guide based in love? Does it accept the frailties of the human condition? Does it encourage or challenge you to be a better human, a brother or sister? Thank you. Stick around and you can pick apart my next defining characteristic, husband. I know my wife will be listening closely.